The next case on our call this morning is Joji against Vogts, number 01-1657.
Has requested briefing on six separate issues, but really the beginning of the court's analysis should be the most important issue in this case, which is whether the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations creates a private, individually enforceable right. The answer to that question is yes. The treaty's plain and clear language indicates that it does, and the International Court of Justice's decision in Legrand also indicates that it does. Once this court answers that question, the remaining issue is what, if any, remedies are available to Mr. Joji.
We do need to answer that in the affirmative, though. Am I correct to move on to the next second issue?
I think that the most direct path to the court is to answer that question in the affirmative, and the clearest way for the court to analyze this issue is to answer that question in the affirmative. It is at least theoretically possible to argue that the ATCA nevertheless creates a cause of action, but in all candor, that's an awfully tough sell for me to make to this court. Ultimately, the real question is whether the Vienna Convention itself indicates that it creates a private right of action. If it does, the question then arises of what remedy is available. This court and numerous other courts have already determined that the suppression of evidence or the dismissal of an indictment or other similar Miranda-type remedies are not available for a plaintiff who has had their Vienna Convention rights be violated.
Mr. Rosenberg, is it your view that any violation of a treaty is a tort? It certainly doesn't seem to fit the traditional definition of a tort, you know, sort of duty, breach, causation, damages. What exactly is the tort here, in your view?
The tort here arises from the Vienna Convention's self-executing nature. There could be a violation of a treaty that, in terms of a tort, does not have a duty to an individual. But what the Vienna Convention does is have that duty to individual detained foreign nationals because it indicates that the rights conveyed therein flow to the foreign national himself. So the answer to the question is no, not every violation of a treaty would result in a tort. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing this name. Many of the case names in the briefs are very difficult. But I think the District of Massachusetts' decision in Zunkax got it right, or at least most succinctly stated how the ATCA may be applied to torts, in that not every treaty violation may in fact create some sort of harm to an individual.
Is it though that this particular part of this particular treaty imposes a duty on somebody toward the individual in question? How does your client pronounce his name?
Joji.
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 Fine. I don't want to make a mistake there. Anyway, so this treaty, creates a particular right that people in the position of Mr. Joji have, and it's sort of like a regulatory tort in a sense, the breach of that duty when it leads to damages, or if it leads to damages, gives him a right to enforce it in court.
I think that's right. I think that the best analogy would be to a Section 1983 claim, which defendants themselves seem to admit would be appropriate in this case. 1983 provides a cause of action for an individual to enforce their rights when those rights are clear and specific and unambiguous and are designed to flow to the individual and are protected by a state. And all of those requirements are met here. The Vienna Convention's language is clear and unambiguous. It mandates action without delay by detaining authorities to inform a detained person of his right to seek consular assistance.
Well, but what injury did Mr. Joji suffer that he would not have suffered anyway
even if the consulate had been notified of his arrest?
Well, I think to answer that question, it's important to bear in mind that Mr. Yogi's claim, his pro se complaint, was dismissed, and the allegations in the complaint, his pro se complaint, should be construed liberally. But as this court has said, a consulate provides what can be described as a cultural bridge. A consulate does not necessarily need to assist an individual in their criminal defense in order for them to provide assistance. And one can imagine being an American citizen traveling abroad or living abroad, being arrested and receiving advice from local counsel and not knowing whether that advice is or is not valid, perhaps not being able to speak or understand the language, perhaps not understanding the cultural institutions and norms that may be applicable to understanding the proceedings.
Is there any reference to emotional damages in the amended complaint? I didn't see it in the complaint or the amended.
In the original complaint, there was a reference to emotional damages construed liberally to the extent that Mr. Yogi has stated that he's been forced to wonder, what if? The amended complaint is actually a very unique situation. The amended complaint was an attempt by Mr. Yogi to bring in the United States government to enjoin his deportation. It incorporated by reference all of the allegations in the original complaint, but other than attempting to bring in the United States, didn't add anything.
But it seems as if the only damage that's claimed is that Mr. Yogi believes the outcome of his case would have been more favorable if the consulate had been involved. And, you know, he's asking for $5 million in compensatory damages, $5 million in punitive, but it's unclear what loss he suffered, to me at any rate, to justify any amount of compensatory damages. And without damages, of course, there'd be no tort. So try to clarify the damage issue for me, please.
Sure. I think, again, his complaint should be read liberally based on his pro se status. And his damages would be, among other things, his lack of access to a cultural bridge, which perhaps he could have pled more clearly, but nevertheless is a form of damages. The other distinction, though, that I think is important to draw is the distinction between the Alien Tort Claims Act and Section 1983. And I draw this court's attention to the Stantz decision from the Southern District of New York. In 1983 actions, nominal damages, for example, are allowed. And at minimum, Mr. Yogi should be entitled to nominal damages for the violation of his rights.
So you're arguing, in a sense, by analogy to, say, Tester cases or that sort of situation where people are trying to find out if landlords don't rent to certain groups, or the convention, as you point out in your brief, is violated hundreds of times every day, and sometimes, as in the Oklahoma case, it's easy to see what the consular assistance could do if there is information in the home country that might throw light on the person's background, or if perhaps local lawyers aren't focusing on deportation consequences, or what have you. I don't know if Mr. Yogi's case is the strongest case on that ground, given how long he had lived in the United States. But maybe that doesn't matter. I don't know.
Well, I think that all of those questions, in some respects, go to factual issues that really have not been developed in this case. I suppose one analogy is it's Tester cases, but I don't think that one even needs to apply an analogy. In Stantz, the district court found that the violation of a Vienna Convention right led to a cause of action under Section 1983, and in that case, the charges were ultimately dropped against the individual. So there was no implication as to the underlying conviction in Stantz. Nevertheless, the plaintiff, whose rights were allegedly violated, was allowed to proceed past summary judgment based on the violation itself.
Could we talk about Heck for a minute? Would you mind?
Sure.
Because if his claim is that he would have had a more favorable outcome in his criminal case, wouldn't Heck bar that claim?
The answer is no, for two reasons. Well, actually, for three reasons. Number one, this court has carved out an exception in Heck versus Humphrey for categories of cases, such as Fourth Amendment cases, that do not necessarily implicate an underlying conviction. And Mr. Yogi's case clearly indicates that his claim does not necessarily implicate the underlying conviction. Again, one can look to the Stant case in the Southern District of New York.
Doesn't he have to get it both ways if that's the case?
I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, he has it both ways if... Well, all right, go ahead.
Well, the first was that it carved out an exception for category cases.
Okay.
Second, Stant, which is a case in which the criminal charges were dropped, is a case that allowed an individual to proceed under their Section 1983 claim for a Vienna Convention violation. Clearly, that case indicates that there is no implication for an underlying conviction because there was no underlying conviction. And the third, defendants themselves have conceded that Heck versus Humphrey.
That's not the case here. There is an underlying conviction, is there not?
There is an underlying conviction. However, Mr. Yogi's claims, at least to the extent that they arise not from his conviction itself, but instead from the violation of the treaty, do not raise the underlying conviction. In other words, there could be a violation of a treaty that gives rise to a cause of action.
All right, let me just get this straight. Is his claim that he would have had a more favorable outcome in his criminal case? Is that his claim?
I think that is one element of his claim. I think that if this court were to reverse, he
you
should be given...
You are dancing with me.
I apologize for that. I'm not trying to. I think that is one element of his claim as he has pled it as a pro se plaintiff. But I think that there's actually quite a bit more to his claim, and construed liberally, his complaint can be read and should be read to give rise to a 1983 action for the violation of the treaty itself. And certainly that aspect of the claim that relates to the treaty violation itself, and the aspect of at least nominal damages as well as potentially punitive damages, may have nothing to do with his conviction. It's quite possible that he could have received assistance from the Indian consulate had he known of his rights and contacted them, yet he still could have been convicted.
Wasn't that the whole point? In other words, the advice one might get from the consulate is, you are in big trouble, a lot of hot water, Americans take this really seriously, and I just want you to know, you've got a real big problem. That would be straight from the shoulder, accurate advice in some circumstances, if delivered, and it's not going to bring about a, quote, more favorable, unquote, answer. It's just that the guy knows where he stands. He's got the lay of the land. Isn't that your basic argument? It's the lay of the land argument. That's what the council gives you, a lay of the land. These locals take this real seriously. You're in a heap of trouble, fella. Don't take this lightly.
I think that's exactly right. I think that this court has described the right to consular access as a cultural bridge to help an individual to understand the proceedings, and in the case here, that Americans take their criminal proceedings very seriously. And similarly, for Americans traveling abroad, they have rights as well to be informed of, you know, their right to contact an American consulate.
For example, when the lawyer comes in, the lawyer may not realize that plea bargaining is a foreign entity for a foreigner. It doesn't happen in a lot of countries. It's indeed regarded as ethically impermissible for a prosecutor to do that. So if the lawyer comes in and offers a bargain, maybe the consulate can say, hey, you know, they do that here. You ought to take it under advisement at least.
I think that's exactly right, Judge Wood, and that really helps to draw at least some of the distinction between the rights that are protected under the Vienna Convention and the Miranda rights. And I think this is one area in particular where the district court made a mistake. The district court noted that the Indian consulate's knowledge of the American legal system was not likely to surpass that of Mr. Yogi's attorney. The question is not whether the consulate's knowledge of the American legal system is likely to surpass that of his attorney. In fact, the Indian consulate probably is not an attorney. Instead, the role of the consulate is to tell the detained national about the consequences of the proceedings and about what the potential harms are, and act as that cultural bridge in case the foreign national has any questions or any concerns.
If that is correct, though, how do we measure damage?
Well, I think that's quite frankly, I think that's the most difficult aspect of this case. I mean, I think the Memphis decision says that you can't place a value on the damages themselves. Nevertheless, we have tort liability in the form of Section 1983 for violations of individuals' rights that we use as deterrents. And that's certainly the factual question, something that Mr. Yogi, should he be permitted to proceed, will probably need to plead with greater specificity the actual harm that he suffered.
How can I'm having difficulty seeing how you can do that. It's some sort of nebulous emotional harm from not having the Indian consulate meet with him. In other words, he doesn't claim he's innocent. He doesn't claim the outcome would have been different. Only that he was deprived of having this person visit with him.
Well, he has alleged that he would have taken advantage of whatever assistance the Indian consulate would have provided. Now, we, of course, don't know what that assistance would have been because the Indian consulate was never contacted. But nevertheless, that's a factual issue that I think that Mr. Yogi should at least be given the opportunity to develop. And if this court permits him to proceed, to the extent there's any question as to whether a tort has been committed, it could allow him to replead a cause of action under Section 1983. He's already pled the basis for that cause of action.
We don't plead legal theories anyway. So since this was dismissed actually under 12b-1, as I recall, I would think at this very early stage, I'm not even 100% clear on these particular facts what the difference between going under the Alien Tort Claims Act and 1983 is. But there are many issues in this case, and you have only 20 minutes. So.
And my white light is on. But I think to clarify the distinction, there was a concern on the part of the district court that the Alien Tort Claims Act has a tort requirement. And an essential element of a tort, according to the district court, is damages. Such requirements does not necessarily exist under Section 1983, where nominal damages exist to vindicate rights on which courts have a great difficulty in determining their value. And I would direct this court's attention to the Bierjew versus Ashcroft case in the District of New Jersey, in which the court noted that the ATCA has a tort requirement, but Section 1983 doesn't. And so certainly that would be a basis for allowing Mr. Yogi to proceed under that statute. Without any other questions, I'd like
and,
to reserve.
And the punitive because the United States violates the convention with regularity.
Not just that the United States violates the convention with regularity, but we don't necessarily know whether or not these individual defendants have violated the convention with regularity. Mr. Yogi did plead that their failure to inform him of his Vienna Convention rights may have been part of a strategy. Certainly, Mr. Yogi would be entitled to discovery on how many foreign nationals these individuals have interacted with in the past, whether they've had any training under the Vienna Convention, and how many times, if at all, they've informed those foreign nationals of their Vienna Convention rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg. We'll hear now from Mr. Light.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Jerome Leick, the attorney for the defendant's appellees. And Mr. Rosenberg has certainly done a fine job, but he has a big hill to climb.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court has hinted that there is an individual right under Article 36. The International Court of Justice has held that there is. So. Tell us why we should disagree.
Well, every U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals case, which has spoken on the issue of whether the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations is the source of individual rights, has either said or inferred that the answer is no. And there are a good number of cases from most of the circuits. Now, while it is true that most of these cases concern motions in criminal cases, they are still good authority in this civil context.
But I'm not so sure about that because, as you rightly say, most of those courts have been focusing very particularly on the various exclusionary remedies or dismissal of indictment remedies that we, too, have rejected. And if there's one thing that's clear from the Supreme Court, it's that violations aren't necessarily addressed by exclusionary remedies. Now, a lot of the cases, in my opinion, have rushed pretty quickly over the issues that, you know, I'm very grateful that both of the parties here have attempted to brief more thoroughly for us, because I don't think this has really been the topic of careful consideration. And some of these other decisions, such as Breard and such as the International Court of Justice, post-date at least some of those cases, not all of them.
I would suggest that your honors not consider the International Court of Justice case to be good authority here, one reason being that that case, in a way, confirms that the remedy for a violation of the Vienna Convention of Consular Relations is an action at the International Court of Justice between nations, not individuals, which is what the optional protocol to the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations states, that that is the forum for disputes concerning the application of the treaty.
Well, it's certainly a forum, because compliance with this treaty is also of interest at the state level, given that when somebody's deported, they wind up in the other country, and this country regularly deports people who've been here from the age of 6 months onward, who wind up someplace where they can't even speak the language. But the court, and as you rightly point out, the United States has consented to its jurisdiction in this particular instance under the optional protocol, I think was pretty clear in its interpretation. Isn't that at least the equivalent of a good law review article, if not more?
Well, I think another interesting thing about that case, though, too, is it provides that there should be remedies for a violation of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations in criminal cases, which all of the circuit court cases have rejected. So it is basically providing a remedy in criminal matters which have been rejected by the United States Circuit Courts of Appeals cases, and I would certainly not suggest that all of those cases should now be pushed aside because there's been a decision at the International Court of Justice at The Hague.
I don't read it that way. I read them as saying there needs to be a remedy appropriately constituted under local law, but you would agree, you know, that there are Bivens remedies in federal cases for unlawful searches, and there are plenty of cases that this court has looked at where we found no heck bar because the complaint was about a Fourth Amendment issue, and even if the person was later convicted, you still have rights under the Fourth Amendment. So those relate to the criminal proceeding, even though they're not exclusionary remedies. I'm not even sure that other countries follow the exclusionary rule, to be honest.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the reasons given in the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals cases are good reasons why the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations does not confer individual rights in civil matters as well as criminal matters. If you look at all the reasons, looking at all the cases, you can kind of boil it down to a number of different reasons given, and they apply equally to in the civil context as the criminal context.
What do you do with the language in Article 36 in the last sentence of paragraph 1b, inform the person concerned without delay of his rights under this subparagraph? Why would they have used the term his rights if they didn't mean the rights of the individual who has been detained? That's the his we're talking about in that sentence.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, that has been brought up by Mr. Rosenberg, and but if you look at other, you know, language in the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, for example, the language of the treaty doesn't provide for remedies in state or federal court. The optional protocol to the treaty says that disputes are to be brought before the International Court of Justice at The Hague between in actions between nations, not individuals. The preamble seems to disclaim an intent to create individual rights.
But you, I mean, of course, international treaties, this one has 92 parties or so, don't go through and specify which domestic laws of each signatory to the treaty are going to be used to implement them. We do have Article 36(2) saying that laws and regulations of the receiving state must enable full effect to be given to the treaty. Now, you do point out the language of the preamble, which I agree says in that particular paragraph, no individual rights. And then the question is what to make of that. Is it in conflict with Article 36? Is it readable as not in conflict? It certainly doesn't delete Article 36, so at the most you'd have to reconcile, I suppose.
The United States in the LeGrand case took the position that in the context of a foreign national in detention, the relevant laws and regulations contemplated by Article 36(2) are those that may affect the exercise of specific rights under Article 36(1), such as those addressing the timing of communications, visiting hours, and security in a detention facility. So I think that is an answer to that question.
But not to beat a dead horse, but Article 36 states, the said authorities shall inform the person concerned without delay of his rights under this paragraph. I noted that, I'm not certain that you really responded to Mr. Yogi's claims for nominal damages or punitive damages. Doesn't he have the right to nominal damages to vindicate the violation of his rights? And wouldn't that alone be enough to sustain the case?
Well, certainly it's our position that the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations is not the source of individual rights, so that he does not have any civil action. I'd also like to say, Your Honors, that obviously Mr. Rosenberg has made some arguments that, for example, if you look at the legislative history, both in Congress and the Trevaux preparatories, many courts say that those indicate that there is no intent to create individual rights. But then you see other decisions or argument by Mr. Rosenberg that indeed those indicate that there was an intent. So what do you do if you have maybe the legislative history could possibly point both ways, if the language could possibly of the treaty could possibly point both ways? I say the weight of authority is that it doesn't create individual rights by the language and by the legislative history, but it seems to me that if we're pointing these things out like Mr. Rosenberg, all it's doing is creating an ambiguity.
When the Supreme Court has looked at various treaties, for example, the Warsaw Convention, it sometimes looks to see the way other signatories to the treaties have interpreted similar language, since after all, we aren't the only game in town when it comes to a 92-person agreement. What have other countries done with respect to civil enforcement?
I can't answer what other countries have done. In the briefs and in the cases, it's discussed how the representative of this country seemed to treat it like it was conferring individual rights, and the representative of this country was treating it like it did not confer individual rights. But I would also say, I think this is a matter of U.S. law and what we want to do here in this country. Again, I believe that in one respect, the decision of LeGrand, where it, I could cite it to you, if I may just have one moment, Your Honors. It says that it voted... Well, I'm sorry, I can't lay my fingers on it right now, but what I am referring to is where it does state that post-conviction relief based on a violation of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations should be available in a criminal matter. And again, that flies in the face of every U.S. Court of Appeals decision which has discussed that. So you know, we can find foreign countries that might have a different view, but I think it's, what is the view here? I would also say this. I certainly think it would be incongruous to say that someone who's about to be executed cannot, that execution cannot be prevented by, because there was a violation of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. But nonetheless, there would be a civil suit available. I don't
think survivors get a dollar in the first
execution. My problem is, and I don't want this to be an unfair question to you, but my problem is it's so easy for the defendants to have said, by the way, you know, there's an Indian consulate, you have a right. You have a right to give him a call, to give her a call, if you feel like it. It just seems so...
And the State Department regulations actually so require, it's just that they're not complied with.
It's not in the record, Your Honor, so I can certainly assure you that that is what is happening in Champaign County right now. I think, well, not necessarily just because of litigation, but a matter of it being brought to their attention. I do think we have a problem in all the various, you know, police departments and sheriff's departments and so forth all over the United States of America, that many of them have simply been unaware of this. And if you look, until quite recently, there was hardly any action, any cases with regard to the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. There's been an awful lot more recently, but if you just go back a few years, you know, you really hardly see it. So, yes, it would have been easy to do it, but nonetheless, I believe that there isn't an individual right here. That certainly is my argument. And if there is not an individual right, the Alien Tort Claims Act doesn't create one. It does not make a non-self-executing treaty self-executing.
But this treaty, I mean, there's a difference between saying that a treaty is self-executing on the one hand, and on the other hand, saying that any particular provision of that treaty creates also an individual right of action. It's like the same debate we have with statutes. When Congress passes a statute, not every statute creates a private right of action to enforce that statute. And sometimes it's even not every part of every statute. So this is the evidence that this is a self-executing treaty is overwhelming. Whether the individual provisions of this treaty create an individual action, I think, is a much more difficult question, which is what you've focused on and Mr. Rosenberg has.
And I don't think there's a dispute that if indeed the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations does not confer rights on Mr. Yogi to sue in the civil action, he doesn't then get that by virtue of the Alien Tort Claims Act.
No, we've been talking about the treaty branch of the Alien Tort Claims Act, on which there's extremely little law, as a matter of fact. Most of the ATCA cases have looked at the law of nations half of the statute, but it's certainly worded in the alternative, a tort in violation of the law of nations or in violation of a treaty.
Yes, but I believe in this case the treaty is controlling, that we don't go into the law of nations, the more ephemeral law of nations, because we do indeed have the treaty.
I don't think there's a dispute between you and Mr. Rosenberg on that much, at least, I don't think.
I don't think there is either, so I do think it hinges on the application of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. With regard to damages, which Your Honors discussed earlier, I do believe that plaintiff's suit is barred by Heck versus Humphrey.
Not
the suit itself, but the damages.
If his claim is for nominal damages, would it be barred by Heck?
Well, his claim is not for nominal damages.
Well, under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, you're entitled to whatever you're entitled to. I mean, just because you said $5 million doesn't mean that's all or nothing.
Well, in his complaint, Mr. Yogi speculates that the outcome of his case would have been more favorable for him had the Indian consulate been involved, and that he now has no choice but to think, what if, for the rest of his prison term?
What does he mean by outcome? Maybe the INS would have been brought in sooner, as it then was called, and he just would have been deported sooner. I mean, you know, there are lots of things that outcome could encompass.
Well, and also in his first brief, he added
to those allegations of damage by merely adding that had the defendants told the plaintiff of his rights under the Vienna Convention, he would have contacted his consulate, who in turn would have told him of the deportation consequences of his guilty plea. So all the damages that he is claiming all derive from the conviction. And under Heck v. Humphrey, he's barred from obtaining those types of damages. And that is why Mr. Rosenberg raises the cultural bridge, and without, you know, demeaning that in any way, shape, or form. And obviously, it's been a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals case. Certainly, I think it's a truism that the consulate can provide that, but as far as an element of damages, I think that's quite a stretch to say that that would be a recoverable element of damage. And very importantly, Mr. Yogi has had a couple of opportunities to allege his damages, and in either instance did he allege that. So I would submit that with regard to the damages issue, the case is barred by Heck versus Humphrey, and also that there's no cause of action at all because the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations does not bestow individual rights. And again, I think it's important to, I would say that, again, the weight is that the authority and the language in the statute and the State Department position, the language in the treaty, the State Department position and so forth, is that it does not bestow individual rights. But if you take into consideration the matters raised by Mr. Rosenberg, the legislative history, the Trevoux preparatories, certain language in the treaty that he took out, again, it seems to me all that does is make it ambiguous. And I think all the authority is that there's a presumption, that particularly if there's ambiguity, that a treaty does not bestow individual rights. And I don't think that there's enough here, certainly, to overcome that presumption. And for the courts then to take a stance which is different than that, is that which is being taken by the executive branch, who apparently has weighed in many times on this issue, and thinks it's important that the that its position be upheld. Unless there's any more questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Light. Mr. Rosenberg, you have 2 minutes remaining.
I'd like to start with the issue of the preamble. There is no ambiguity in this treaty. Article 36 clearly indicates that a private right exists. Now, some courts have held that the preamble's language conflicts with the clear and unambiguous language of Article 36. It does not. I would direct this court's attention to what we've marked as Addendum 2 and 3 in our brief, which is the actual preamble language. That language says, realizing that the purpose of such privileges and immunities is not to benefit individuals. The previous paragraph of the preamble defines what those privileges and immunities are. On Addendum 2, the preamble states, believing that an international convention on consular relations, privileges, and immunities. So the preamble is defining privileges and immunities to be consular privileges and immunities, not privileges and immunities for individual nationals. And indeed, if the drafters of the treaty had wanted to have the treaty not convey individual rights, they could have clearly done so in the preamble itself. Instead of saying, realizing that the purposes of such privileges and immunities is not to benefit individuals, they could have simply said, realizing that the purposes of such purpose of this treaty is not to benefit individuals. They did not use that language, and therefore the preamble does not conflict with the clear and unambiguous language of Article 36. The other fundamental question that this court seems to be grappling with is the issue of damages. If there is a right, there should be a remedy. Now, defendants admit that the Vienna Convention is violated all of the time. This court has an opportunity to send a message. That's why you get damages in causes of action such as under Section 1983. Mr. Yogi has pled the basis for compensatory damages, but to the extent that he is not, he should be given an opportunity to go back and replead his claim. Both his complaint and his amended complaint were both filed as a pro se prisoner, and we believe that he would be given that opportunity, he would be able to state a claim for damages. but at minimum under Section 1983, he's entitled to nominal damages as well as punitive damages, unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg.
Thank you.
My thanks to both counsel today. Mr. Rosenberg, you and your colleague undertook this case by appointment of the court, and the court is not unaware of the tremendous